Welcome to Cloudlandia,
Mr. Sullivan.
That was really fast. I was about 15 seconds ahead of you this morning.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, but what I noticed in Cloudlandia, and welcome to everybody to Cloudlandia, promptness is becoming an important capability.
It really is, and you hit on it very early on as one of the top four things. Show up on time.
Yes.
Yeah, that's been, I'm having fun with that. You know, as I've told you, our 12-year-old is, sharing this wisdom with him and seeing all the different areas that it's important in life. How much time, you know, dependability is something that indicates to people, you know?
Yes.
And then finishing what you start, that you're not going to leave them.
Yeah, you know, one thing that occurs to me that in the mainland, before we had Cloudlandia, there were many, many plausible excuses for why you weren't on time. Traffic, you know, caught up in traffic, and, you know, that would probably be, you know, a variation of caught up in traffic is probably, you know, flights were delayed.
Right.
All sorts of things. But in Cloudlandia, unless there's a general blackout, you know, of the electrical grid, there really aren't a lot of excuses. You know, network is down. You know, that could be plausible, but generally speaking, there's probably no plausible reason why, if you say something's going to start at a certain point, why someone should not be able to make that.
Yeah. Do you know what's funny is that I went to meet someone over at Celebration here in Orlando last week, and we're so conditioned now to meeting in Cloudlandia that how efficient and clean and you know, just sharp it is, right? That it struck me as almost like you see the I don't know, the extra burden or extra, like all the extra baggage of, you know, it's 40 minutes away. So I leave like an hour ahead of time to give me time to, I like to show up on time. So I want to, on time is being there early and leaving a margin for any traffic or anything like that. So, you know, I was there, left an hour ahead of time and got there. We had a, you know, 2.5 hour meeting, lunch, and then it took, you know, 45 minutes to get home. So, you know, you think about that, there's an hour, a couple of extra hours almost of time that wasn't the meat of the issue kind of thing. It wasn't the main event. And that's where we were talking about the, you know, as I'm looking forward to our strategic coach workshops on Monday and Tuesday, we're right now having the luxury of doing this podcast today, but normally I would have to be, I'd be in the final things of packing to head to the airport right now to get on the plane to arrive in time for dinner this afternoon in Chicago with you. And then, it's such a,
You know, and the interesting thing that I find more and more is that what I've noticed is that people who don't like the internet, don't like, you know, virtual conferencing, if I had to pick the people who are late for showing up for a Zoom call, they're in the company of people. I haven't done actual research on it, But it also strikes me that there are the people who don't like the internet, and maybe one of the reasons why they don't like the internet is because it requires punctuality.
It works
in both directions. Everything's a chicken and egg situation in life. But I've noticed, and they show up late, but then their lighting isn't good, and oftentimes they're looking at a second computer, and they're not looking at the audience. I think it's kind of like 100 years ago, I don't really know about this telephone stuff, and it may be a general resistance to more than one thing, that mm-hmm. life is changing abruptly, really. I mean, depending on what you thought the future was going to be in early 2020, the change was either, something that you had accounted for in your mind, you had actually psychologically, emotionally prepared for yourself. But sometime in the future, we'll probably switch over to virtual conferencing, which will bypass a lot of travel. Or you thought that, 10 years into the future and 2030, there wasn't going to be any difference in how you conducted your daily life and your business life,
Mm-hmm.
It all depends upon what your mind and your, spirit has really prepared yourself for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, and it's an interesting thing. People are either going to, embrace that or not. Mm-hmm. I love it. I mean, it's funny how now you start to see, I wonder if people, once we've been, because it's coming up on a year of successfully mm-hmm. doing the all virtual mm-hmm. workshop.
Yeah.
I wonder how it's going to feel when the first time back you realize, oh, now I've got to, all the schlepping and everything involved in doing it.
Yeah. Well, we actually had a measurement that told us that we've been successful because our last sales quarter, this would be for October, over the last 4 years, the U.S. government has established the calendar year as the fiscal year. In other words, the year of 2020 is the fiscal year for everybody for taxation purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have switched from a March 31st for most of our existence. March 31st was always the end of our fiscal year. In other words, it was the 9 months of the year before plus 3 months in the new year. But, Price Waterhouse, who does our accounting, actually for all three countries. So we have, a company in the U.S., a company in Canada, and a company in London. And they said, now everybody's switching over now. Everything has to be on the calendar year.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which is neither here nor there. There might be some inconvenience because of the way that you plan things previously, but once you make the adjustment, it's just normal like it used to be. And so our last quarter of was a normal in-person. The results that we got from the sales was equal to a normal quarter.
That's great.
So,
yeah.
But it's all virtual. They're all signing up virtual workshops, and that's the big thing. Will they sign up? In the same numbers. For virtual that they did for in person. And basically it took 6 months for us to return to the results that we were used to before the COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so what time are the works. How long are you doing the days now? I've forgotten.
6 hour. There's new what we call classic workshops. Okay. And a classic workshop is virtual now, but when people have freedom, it will become a in-person workshop. But they're signing up now for a virtual version. And then there's the global workshops, which are on a different schedule. The global workshops, instead of 4 days a year, it's 6 days a year. Instead of 6 hours on each of those days, it's 4 hours on each of those days.
I gotcha.
Yeah, so it's 24
hours. What are our workshops? What is our, so tomorrow?
Six tomorrow and six on Tuesday.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, there we go. So from 10 to
about
4
or whatever. No, we take breaks. And
I enjoy it. It's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, yeah, that I can't. I'm excited. You know, it's interesting. I got your, I got the package with the $15 trillion free zone book. And so I haven't yet, it's been peeking at me, you know, I haven't had a chance to sit down and read it yet, but today I've got my eye on it. So it's really, I think, you know, that would be, it's a really interesting thing that is really something that it seems like would really fit into Cloudlandia here, that these are the things. I've been observing that whole the Mr. Beast burger situation that we were talking about, and everything's going strong there. And, you know, just instantly opening 300 restaurants in collaboration with excess capacity. Mm-hmm. It's such a it could only happen in Cloudlandia. You know, that's not even, it would not be possible on the mainland.
Yeah, what's really interesting, Dean, when I think that we go back to, I call it complete choice. In other words, people choose their ratio of in-person to Cloudlandia, you know, now we're going to say how much of your daily life is mainland and how much of your life is Cloudlandia, you know?
Yeah.
I think we're making a strong push for this, that people start thinking in those terms. With your coming up with the name Cloudlandia, you know, I think it's an interesting thing. But for example, let's say, you know, I'm just projecting with Beast Burger, it proves to be a really hot thing that a hamburger restaurant in a locale does much, much better because they have this Beast Burger dimension where none of the other hamburger restaurants in their area have.
Yes.
Then you begin to see the Starbucks effect, and I'm just wondering, you know, will he seems to do things for the fun of it. So
yes,
I mean, Mr. Beast seems to be a guy who's always looking for new toys and new playpens, you know, new toy boxes. But for example, you might get, you know, a chain. I remember, I think Marriott was the first hotel chain that got Starbucks into all their hotels. And now Mr. Beast, with his Beast Burger, really, really becomes the buyer, not the seller.
Mm-hmm.
One large chain of hospitality places, you know, says we have to have Beast Burger as part of our food offering in our hotels.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so that's, yeah. And that shows you the power, and that can happen instantaneously because he's shown that, you know, that whereas he was able to start 300 restaurants in a day, if a hotel chain had 1,500 locations.
Exactly.
They could start in 1,500 locations could start on the same day too.
So that is, there's the perfect example of a VCR formula collaboration in action, that the vision, Mr. Beast Burger, the whole, the menu, the everything like that, all of that vision, the capability means you got to have the kitchen to prepare it, the ability to do it. And like you said, a hotel chain with the reach of 1,500 locations could open 1,500 locations at one time.
Yeah. Just like that. Yeah.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Vision plus capability multiplied by reach. That's the the perfect thing. I've just noticed.
This, say, this is sort of like an intellectual shortcut package. You know, when you take it apart, you know, if you did reverse engineered what it took to think through how just one hamburger, existing hamburger business, would on a certain day just go 100% fully active with Beast Burger, you would see that there's probably within the project, you know, on day one, you say, okay, we're going to do this, you know, and then there has to be all these, you know, things like, well, you have to have the qualified cooks, you have to have the qualified menu, you have to, you know, there's procedures, there's quality control and everything. And each of those is an intellectual shortcut, and the entire Beast Burger capability is probably, you know, could be dozens of different intellectual shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole Beast Burger concept is an intellectual shortcut, how to go live. But, you know, a restaurant might say, you know, we're going to start a whole new way of approaching things. And it's like 6 or 7 months work for them to do it on their own. They don't have to work at all with Beast Burger. They just have to agree to it happening and check off the boxes that they've got the capability to fulfill the promise.
Beast Burger. Yeah. And so you look at that. I'm starting to see all of these things. I told you about the ice cream shop, which was the, you know, Unilever's idea of using excess cooler capacity to stock their ice cream all over town and put it up on Grubhub. The latest that I just discovered yesterday on Grubhub, there's a restaurant here in the States called Boston Market, and they do rotisserie chickens, and so you're probably familiar with them.
Long time company. That's quarter century old.
Yep. And so now they've launched on Grubhub a restaurant called Rotisserie Roast, and they've got different. You know, it looks like they've got different branding, different things, but it's the same address as the Boston Market. So they're basically selling this other menu out the back door on just on Grubhub and Seamless using, you know, ingredients that they have packaged a little differently and combined a little differently for some healthier or lighter combos, but it's so brilliant. I mean, you just look at it. I'm tuning my my vision for it to start to really recognize these opportunities everywhere. I mean, if you can recognize the assets that people have, the excess. You recognize the excess capacity and you recognize the reach.
Combining
those, I mean, putting people together with reach and capability that don't have the vision, you can, you know, it's really like the way that you can find your way in Cloudlandia without your capability could be vision, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. The whole franchising concept of food and lodging really started with the railroads. And not the railroads themselves, but I'm going to have to do a little research on this because I'm just bringing up the thought right now. And, you know, in the future, I'll have the actual information on this.
Okay.
Especially when the first two transcontinental railroads went through, so that was the Union Pacific and the Southern Pacific. One went from Chicago all the way to San Francisco.
Yes.
And I think the other one, I don't know if it's, there was certainly a connector from Chicago, but I think the launching point of it was the Southern Pacific. I think it was probably from St. Louis and it went south, mm-hmm. you know, to Los Angeles, but, you know, each of them about a 2,000 mile trip. Mm-hmm. And, they had all these, you know, they had express trains, and then they had, you know, gradually when they got multi-tracks, you know, they could have express trains. And then they had, you know, locals, you know, people would go, you know. And one of the real problems was that you couldn't guarantee at any particular town or city that you stopped in that the quality of the food and the quality of the, you know, the overnight stay, the hospitality stay would it be an experience consistent with the quality that the railroads were promising, you know, for the trip. And so this guy, and he, it wasn't the railroads themselves, but he began creating hotels and restaurants at key points, and then he would staff them. He would staff them, and he guaranteed, you know, the staffing. He would guarantee the training. He would guarantee the quality. So in another day, you know, I mean, if you take your Mr. Beast into Cloudlandia, this was the beginning of using, you know, creating a new capability on top of an existing capability.
Yeah. I mean, so that's the thing about standardizing things.
If you use your VCR, your vision capability and reach, the vision is that we'll have, you know, 80 of these hotel restaurant complexes across the United States. What's the capability? It's the Union Pacific and Southern Pacific Railroads. And that's the reach. And then, you know, the reach is that you have the capability to do one of them, so you automatically have the capability to do 80 of them.
You're right.
And it guarantees standardization.
Yeah.
Well, you think about that model
really followed then Holiday Inn, like when we started doing on the roads, all the motels and stuff.
Well, Holiday Inn would have followed the railroad one because the Holiday
Inn. Yeah, that's what I mean. Same model, right? Yeah. And Cracker Barrel.
And Howard Johnson restaurants, White Castle hamburgers, you know, Dairy Queen, you know.
Yeah.
There were lots of them. And what it was is that you already had a preconditioned customer.
Yeah.
And, you know, for example, when Babs and I traveling, you know, a distance, like we go 400 or 500 miles, we check where all the McDonald's are.
Yes.
Not for the food.
Bathrooms. That's right. Because you know they're going to be clean.
Yeah. Tim Hortons. There's Tim Hortons halfway between our house and our cottage. And so we go in. I don't think we've ever bought anything.
Wow. So you think about the, that model. you know, impossible with, you know, but now when you look at with no physical locations or the ability, I was thinking about when you were talking about some of these restaurants, you think like just kind of, it was already kind of dying around my time, but I understand it used to be that the drive up restaurants were a big thing where you could drive up and park your car and they would, you know, bring your food to your car and you'd sit there and eat. We had, when I was young, we had an A&W. That was like that. So you'd pull in and they'd hook the tray up to your car and bring your food and you'd eat there. But then once the drive through became more popular, those kind of disappeared, right? We don't, most of the,
well, I think that, you know, it'd be interesting what the chicken and the egg was here, because a lot of people had the experience of drive-in theaters at that time, and they drive in and they'd have, you know, they'd have staff that would come around to the cars and they would deliver, you know, soft drinks, popcorn.
That really started in the 50s, didn't it? Was it the thing like,
yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure. You know, it might have started earlier, you know, I mean, had cars and, you know, and, so I think that, anything you can do with a car, you know, the I guess business would flow along with it. I certainly remember that. And, you know, and it was a bit clunky, though. You know, I mean, you always had a, I always found there was a clunkiness about the service, you know. You know, if one staff member was off that night, you know, it probably interfered with, you know, people say drive-in, you know, we'll serve you at your car, but then you're waiting 15 minutes, 20 minutes, probably. There was some natural pitfalls to it because, you know, it really required, you know, really required that you have super fast response.
Yeah, I wonder how restaurants will fare kind of, you know, going forward. Now, what I was getting at was when we look at, it's almost like that model that they talked about in the Tyranny of Convenience, that once we kind of, all progress is sort of ratcheted, you know, you don't sort of go backwards on that. We lock in that level as the norm. And I think what this, you know, COVID time or our quarantine time or our staying away time has done is normalize every restaurant food is available at your doorstep in 30 minutes, you know? And I wonder now if when that comes back, when it's normal to go to all the restaurants again, I wonder how much like lost that will be, because it used to be the only, you know, you would go to, if I look before Grubhub, before Seamless, so let's even go back, you know, 2 years ago, really, if I look at the landscape, it just in Winter Haven, in my outpost of the mainland, there were very few options for delivery, you know, like all the pizza places delivered and maybe some of the Chinese food places, but you had to call them all individually to arrange that and organize it, right? You had to know the menu, know all of that stuff. And so whatever you, what you would often go out if you didn't want to have that limited menu, you resign yourself to, well, okay, we'll go there and eat because you want their food. But there's nothing magical about the everyday dining experience in a regular restaurant. It's not like you're going to, you know, a fine dining experience, which there is a place for that. That I think is always going to stay. But the everyday, you know, routine dining, it just feels like we're not going backwards to that.
Yeah, maybe there's already a model for this, Dean, but it's in a completely another sector, which is banking. There used to be a thing called bank. There used to be
banking hours. I can't remember the last time I ever set foot in my bank.
Yeah. And, you know, a bank, you know, you say, what's the nearest ATM? Well, the ATM can be at a bank, but the ATM can be in a convenience store. You know, it could be in a shopping, it could be in a supermarket, the ATM could be in a supermarket. And so, the big thing about banking hours, you know, was that generally, you know, that the hours coincided when a majority of people were nearby doing their working hours, you know, like you're doing that. And then, but it really limited the reach of the banks. You could, I mean, you basically couldn't do banking unless there was actually a bank building. And then with digitalization, the banking became a digital experience. And my sense is, I'm just thinking of a particular restaurant in our local neighborhood here that went to takeout pretty quick. You know, like if they, you know, if they were locked down, say in the second week of March, they went to takeout, you know, certainly before the end of the month. And it struck me that I always thought that, for example, this restaurant only does evening meals, you know, be open from around 5 to 10 normal days. And then Friday and Saturday, it would be maybe 5 to 11, 5 o'clock. And they did a great business. They were always filled. But I was looking at the hours. You know, so that's about 5 or 6 hours of each day. But there would be from, let's say, 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock. So 9 hours when, if they had food available during that time, you know, there would be customers to buy it. And that's what they discovered.
Yeah.
And the thing that shifted is they didn't have the restaurant open for breakfast and lunch because where they're located, people are at work during the day. So it wouldn't be available. But I bet half the people won't be at work during the day. Half the people will be at
neighborhood. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Just it's everything is shifting like that, right? The new norms are that everybody's kind of staying in the suburbs or staying in the the population is more mobile. I think this is like a big, big shift, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting. One of the things we've noticed in delivery services that I would say since last March that UPS is infinitely superior to FedEx or to Amazon in terms of delivery service.
UPS is. They're the winner.
In the sense that they always, well, we have three houses, and they always come to the right house, and they always deliver it right to the door.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things I've noticed about FedEx and Amazon, one is I think they go through drivers really quickly. You know, the delivery people, they go, you know, you don't know who the delivery. UPS, it's always the same person because, for example, in our Chicago office, we've had two different UPS pickup people in 22 years. And in our Toronto office, we have the same UPS driver after 29 years.
Hmm. Wow, that's something.
Yeah, well, they're shareholders. UPS. Yeah. The employees are shareholders of the company, you know, and they've got a build up of of a pension pot. As they do their years, but they have complete familiarity with everything that's going on in their neighborhood. And the other thing is, you know, they only make right hand turns. You know, that system that they have, that they have a computer now that plans out the driver's trips based on the packages, and they never make left hand turns.
I had no idea about that. Is that true?
Yeah. So their whole trip beforehand is planned out by computer, and it just tells them the continual set of right hand turns to make, because they found that left hand turns can cost them up to a half hour on a trip.
On a day. Wow. And the block of getting stuck in traffic lights, all that stuff. Only right hand turns. Yep. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
All that efficiency stuff, you see?
Yeah, but that's the only thing you can do if you have Cloudlandia capabilities, because it's all, it's the package has a label, and it has an address on it, and it's all fed into the computer ahead of time and say, Jack, here's your schedule for today. Here's all the packages. And what the packages tell us, that this is your route when you're out there, and we're not going to require you to make a left-hand turn during this time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really that they've really been great in the relationship. They've had an amazing collaboration with Amazon for a lot of years, which really goes a long way. Does Amazon ship exclusively with UPS, or do they do FedEx and others too?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I know for sure it was with UPS, but now they're about to get in that business themselves too, which is something.
Yeah, the real problem is a general problem that they're going to face, and that is traffic congestion. Uh-huh. You know, if everybody's going to delivery services, it means that there's going to be a lot of cars and trucks on the road. It's the one problem that you can't solve because it's a mainland. It's mainland activity.
It's a constraint.
I think the whole notion that you're going to have drones delivering things is a non-starter.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about, I was thinking about the collaborations like that, right? Like if you think about the collaboration with Amazon and UPS that they've got, which would seem like the perfect collaboration. They've got the sales, they've got all the stuff. UPS has this existing network of being able to deliver packages to every address in the world, basically. So a natural collaboration there, but seemingly a little bit more, less stable for UPS in a way. When you're saying, I wonder about, I haven't read the $15 trillion free zone yet, but I know you always talk about this idea of always be the buyer. And you wonder, like, UPS is kind of in a situation where they're not the buyer in the Amazon situation, right?
I would say that Amazon has proven over the years that if you get in business with them, they'll try to reproduce your business.
Right. That's what I wonder, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, let's do a collaboration with UPS for 2 years and learn everything they do and how they do it. And then we'll just reproduce their system and undercut them. We'll just undercut them, and the problem is that I think it's so built into Amazon's business model to do that, the reputation would go before them for any potential collaboration.
Yeah.
And the other thing with UPS is that they're an employee. They have such an employee ownership of their entire company that it's not like a straight corporation that's a public equity based, you know, where you can just sell this or anything like that. It's the very strength of UPS makes it hard for the CEOs of UPS just to make a decision like that. Yeah.
And you wonder, I look at the, you know, in a way, you look at these capabilities that are out there, even from a platform standpoint. Like, we look at what Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, all of these things, and it's, you know, very timely, actually, to be talking about this right now in the wake of Trump being delisted from Twitter, as you know, he was using them for his reach, using their capability to get to his 86 million followers.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was taken away immediately, like instantly from him. And you wonder, like, I wonder, that's, there's a really interesting dynamic there when we take these things for granted. Like, if you're building a platform, you're building a YouTube community, and then all of a sudden YouTube says, okay, no more, then you've,
I think this is where the antitrust legislation kicks in, and the two networks. Apple did it too. Apple.
You're starting to see everybody's flexing now, right? Flexing.
Apple did it. Facebook did it, and Twitter. I don't know what the Google situation is at the end of this week. Same. Okay. So what this tells me now is that they've declared themselves publishers and not platforms, that they're not platforms anymore. They're publishers, and they're now using full, editorial power to say, we won't allow...
I think it opens up a big can of worms for them, right?
Well, I think it opens up a huge competitive market, because I'm sure the knowledge needed to create a social media network and to, the social media companies, as powerful as they are, they don't own the internet. The internet is a system. So my sense is that anyone who wants to create a new, there's other search engines, there's other social media. So my sense is that Trump, whenever the mainstream media makes makes a statement, well, this is the end of him now. This is it. He's completely gone. He's forgotten and everything like that. It's a bit like watching another episode of the Coyote and the Roadrunner.
Right, exactly.
And my sense is that... you could look at it. Yeah, this is the end of this individual's political career, and it's finished. And very clearly, he's shamed and humiliated forever. You could look at it that way, or you said, he just really consolidated his 90 million followers. Mm-hmm. And if he says, I'm going to create a new social network, and I'd like all of you to switch over from Facebook to Twitter to my new social network, and don't watch Fox News anymore. Watch MAGA News, or whatever the name is.
Right.
I call it the Freedom Network. It would be the Freedom Network. It would be social media. It would be cable. It would be all the other features and everything like that. And I was going to bring this up as a topic because it seems to me now that, you know, that Apple and Facebook and Twitter and Google are doing at the corporate level what China and Russia have been trying to do at the national level, to have their entire, you know, their own internet world. And what it tells me is that politics is entering into Cloudlandia.
Well, that's true. Even on a level like I saw, even you know, the response to that was Parler has been getting some traction
at
the conservative side, but now Amazon stopped hosting Parler servers on their cloud. So even at
Apple did it yesterday.
Apple cut them out of the App Store. And Amazon cut them off their cloud server, which 80% of the internet runs on AWS servers. You realize, wow, you're getting back now to where these guys are starting to flex their personal views on things.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Rockefeller did the same thing with oil and the end of the oil and gas at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, and what they did was they locked up all the railroad, because all the shipments were done by railroad, and they locked up contracts for the railroads would agree they would only ship Rockefeller oil,
and would not ship
oil from any other producer. And what you start running into is the U.S. Constitution. Okay. And no matter how powerful Amazon is, they're puny compared to the U.S. Constitution. I mean, it's like they're just a moment in time in regard to the U.S. Constitution. So my sense is that this is kind of a, it's a kind of a civil war moment of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual civil war in the United States was about slavery, but actually there was probably a deeper cause than slavery. I think slavery was a hot emotional topic, but it was actually about the fact that part of the country was industrializing at a rate, and the other part of the country wasn't industrializing at all. And so it was, you know, if you go back, Dean and Dan are talking in 1860, and we're talking about the difference between the farm country and the factory country. You know, welcome to the factory world.
Yeah, right. Right.
We're having the
welcome
same
to industrial land. Right, exactly.
Yeah. So my feeling is that when you get a big shift like this, which is economic, I mean, it hits upon all, how people think about things, how they feel about things, how they relate to each other. When it starts becoming, that there's a total shift of personal existence from one realm to the other, you get the type of issues that we're getting with the past week. And the difference is there's not a great deal of bloodshed this time.
Yeah, this is going to be what a fun decade we're in for, you know, as you start to see.
The history of the United States is pretty chock full of this. For the first, the country started in 1789 officially, and then it went 100 years. It went through the entire 19th century and right up to 1916, so it was like 136 years, where it kind of paid attention to just what was going on in America. And then starting with the First World War and, you know, for the next 100 years, we got involved with every other part of the planet. But Americans kind of like, you know, paying attention to America. And I think it may be a shift back to that America is going to look at America first. And then if you want a deal, offer us something. The U.S. isn't going to consider itself the world policeman and the world regulator of how right. other people run their countries. And I think it's part and parcel of that. I mean, there's no one explanation for anything. There's always about 20 explanations together, which right. kind of tell you this. But, I think power goes to the head of people who think that they are now unaccountable. They don't have to account. Like, my feeling is that at the top of these big digital companies, there's a certain sense of invincibility. Mm-hmm. And we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, that's, when you look at that, the whole, I just read this morning that Biden's expected to announce $3 trillion in stimulus coming up here, all, mm-hmm. Focused on making America great again, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think first of all, it's a very unpredictable country, that mm-hmm. we're citizens of. And, nobody gets to be on top for very long in the U.S.
Right.
Politically, nobody gets to be on top for very long in terms of, celebrity. Celebrity is fickle and fleeting. You can be up for a little bit and then you're.
Yeah.
Yeah. And same thing economically. You can, even Jeff Bezos says, I don't expect Amazon to exist 20 years from now. He says, I think we will have been replaced by something else.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder what he sees as the end game, like where does that head? I've been very impressed with the way Elon Musk has called his shots all the way through the from the beginning, and he's now become he just took over as the richest guy now, right?
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means, but yeah.
Oh. I mean, it was like Warren Buffett, I remember in the 1987 stock market crash, they said, he lost $10 billion today. He was interviewed on the
1987. Yeah, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he said, well, it was paper this morning and it's paper tonight. He said, yeah. But he predicted, when the Dow was in the 2000s, I think it went from 2,700 to 1,800 on one day. And, it lost a third of the value of the stock market.
Right.
And he says, well, how long is this, this blow to the world and everything going to happen? And he says, I think by a year 2000, so this is 1980. So he says, I think about the year 2000, the Dow will be over 10,000, which would be four times what it had ever been, And he says, well, how can you possibly say that? And he says, most of the working scientists, most of the working engineers, most of the working entrepreneurs that we've ever had on the planet are alive today, and they're all getting connected electronically. So I just got to believe there's going to be a constant creation of new things to invest in. And I think money available to invest in it. So, And he says the whole thing is just try. He says the whole secret of it is just see if you can buy a dollar for less than a dollar.
Right. That's a great thing. The value investing. Yeah. I haven't paid attention. I've got to read his, I always enjoy reading his letters. Yeah. I'm a shareholder, a Berkshire shareholder. So I always get the annual reports. Yeah. And I'd love to see his take on things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he has the sense of, you know, just what's a great brand. What great brand still has room to grow?
Durable advantage. That's what he calls it. Yeah, durable advantage. Right.
You know, durable advantage, and I think he has some winners and losers, but generally speaking, he his batting average is good, and do it. And I just think we're in a new phase. You know, I mean, I was just looking at it because we're interested in legal matters these days. And I was just looking at the Article 1 of the Constitution, and it's the eighth section of the first article. So the first article. And the reason for intellectual property protection, and it was for the expansion of scientific and technical knowledge and capabilities throughout society. This is why. So there's always this border where we're going to give you a certain monopoly status under the law so that, so that you can be rewarded for creating something new. That's part of the intellectual property law. And the other thing is that other people encourage to be innovators. But the third thing is that overall, it's for the benefit of society that new capabilities, new vision, new capabilities, and new reach is introduced into society. Okay. So if you have a sense that Facebook isn't doing that anymore, if you have a sense that Twitter isn't doing that anymore, if you have a sense that Apple isn't, or Amazon or Google isn't doing this more, then their monopoly will be taken away from them.
Yeah. And so I wonder how that will be the better thing, though. Like, part of their monopoly is because you only have to, like, how do you, this is what I wonder, is how do you take away a Google monopoly without disadvantaging everybody? You know, like, how do you, like, part of the value of it is having everything in one place. Like, you go there because it's got everything.
Well, that's kind of, there's two ways of looking at it. You know, they're so crucial that we can't possibly change it. Or you could say, what better things are being prevented by their monopoly? Maybe their model is getting old, but they've positioned themselves so that new, better things can't come along. Yeah, well, I just looked at when Standard Oil was broken up, which was around 1910. The oil industry in the next 30 years expanded by 10 times. Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When AT&T was broken up in the 1950s, Bell had the monopoly on telephones. The telephone industry went 10 times. All sorts of the Bell would never have invented the digital phone.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And all these landlines. The first person to invent an electronic camera was a Kodak employee,
Right. Yeah, the digital camera, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can just see how persuasive he was when he told someone at the top, in the future we won't have to sell film anymore.
Right. What now? Right, exactly.
Everybody thinks that the existing solution is the ultimate, and who knows what else. I mean, you were telling me about Clubhouse on our last meeting. I looked into it and I said, well, this is a bypass. This is a bypass. And if Facebook tried to create a clubhouse type thing, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, but I would, you know, I don't trust anything that Facebook does. I don't trust anything Twitter does, you know, so these are not trustable people. So anything new that they try to go over, I don't really trust them, you know?
And,
And you know, and Jeff Bezos and Elon, they just want to walk on Mars.
That's it. That's exactly right. They just want to walk on Mars.
You're
asking, oh, that's funny.
What's the end game? The end game is both of them want to walk on Mars, you know?
And, right.
And, you know, and I was talking about goal setting the other day. You know, don't make the achievement of your future goal the criteria of when you start to like yourself. You know, I said, you know, if I walk on Mars, then will I like myself? You know,
so yeah, right.
You know, have different motivations. Don't have that. So anyway, well, this is just the first of 3 days when we'll be chatting. So I look forward.
I'm excited. I want to, I'm going to read the,
I would appreciate if you could, take in the, you know, the 15 trillion and talk about it. You know, I mean, people are, you know, they have a time phase when they read things, but we're noticing a big jump in interest in the free zone since we put the book out. I would say
that's
number of 10 times.
Well, now that people understand what it means, that they get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing, it's my project, you know, it's my 24-year project and, this is what's going to keep me interested and motivated for the next 24 years.
I love it. I'm happy to have a front row seat.
Yeah. Well, you're more than front row seat.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. So I will see you in the morning. I'm sorry or sad we can't have dinner tonight, but, I'll see you bright eyed and bushy tailed in the morning.
We put out the word we're going to have a cocktail party, but it's strictly optional because other people may have other things to do. So we finish at 3 and we have a cocktail party at 5, you know. And
okay, so we're finishing at 3 Chicago time. And so 4 o'clock.
Three Chicago time.
So 4 Eastern. Right. Okay.
Four Eastern,
All right.
All right.
Well, I will see you in the morning.
Yep. Good.
Thanks. Bye.